Hello, I'm B'nai Naudin, and this is The Process. It's interesting how one thing leads to another. Several years ago, I worked as a roving reporter, and I happened on a performance which blew me away. It wasn't so much the performance itself, although it was good. It was more the subject of the performance, which was a historical figure I knew nothing about, Prudence Crandall. I made a decision while watching the performance that I was going to do something with it. And I approached the actress at the end, and one thing led to another, and several years later, I had a documentary film. One of the people who was in the film was a museum curator, and she was in charge of the Prudence Crandall Museum, and really helped me through the process of making the film by making herself available, by providing me with tons of information, by putting me in contact with local historians and experts. And today, we will be listening to how she got into this business and how she got involved with the museum and what it took to put it all together. So I hope you enjoy this episode of The Process with Kazimira Koslowski. Today I'm with Kaz Koslowski, or Kazimira Koslowski, who was for many, many years the museum director and curator of the Prudence Crandall Museum in Canterbury, Connecticut. Welcome, Kaz.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, B'nai. I've been looking forward to this.
Great. So I'm very curious about your career as a museum director. You're my first museum director that I've actually gotten to know.
Well, I'm not your typical director, but
I'm curious about how you got into this business.
Well, I think then that's part of why I'm not your typical, because it was purely by happenstance. The way my educational, kind of the trajectory went, this was not expected or anticipated, but it was kind of a very pleasant, and it turned out to be a very positive accident. My undergraduate was actually, I was looking forward to doing art education, and was in my junior year doing student teaching and realized that it just was not a good fit. I didn't enjoy it. Honestly, it was kind of this moment of panic, thinking, where am I going to go from here when I'm in my third year? And it just, I can't overemphasize how uncomfortable and unpleasant that situation was for me. But on the upside was I had an advisor who I was able to go to, and I was doing my work down at Central Connecticut State College. And my watercolor instructor was my advisor, and I sat with her and I said, you know, I've got a problem because I'm not sure what direction to go in, because I know I can't go into education because I would just not be a positive asset to that. And Mrs. Brown said, you know what, Kaz? And I don't even know how she knew intuitively to set me in that direction, but she said, I have a friend who's a museum director over at the Museum of Connecticut History. Would you like me to call David White and see if he might have a work study position that you can kind of get your feet wet and see if that might be a good fit? She called, I went, and I loved it. It was something that I was able to use that artistic background that I truly enjoyed, and it was using education, but in a different way. And that first experience in 1970, whatever it was, kind of put me in line with how my future was to go.
Can you talk about that internship or that work study program that you did?
Yep. It was over at the Museum of Connecticut History, which is still there. It's housed in the same building that the state Supreme Court is in. It's across the street from the Capitol. And their collection entails Connecticut local history. They have a very strong Colt firearms collection. They have political information and archival materials. And when I was working there, David White was kind enough to basically had me doing every aspect. I was cataloging, I was shadowing. At that point, the museum guards were doing the tours. I was shadowing tours. And then at one point, he allowed me to do exhibits. And this shows how far back it was. The big excitement was the moon rock that I was able to use in an exhibit there at the State Library. And again, having that soup to nuts experience really laid the groundwork for my career, you know, the past 35 years when I was at the Crandall Museum, because that also entailed soup to nuts. Mm-hmm. I needed to be kind of adept at every aspect of museum work.
So when you say you created an exhibit, your first exhibit with David White, what kind of things did you do? How did you put it together?
Never having done that, I saw how they were doing the installations, and then he chose the topic. The moon landing, they brought back pieces of the moon and supplied them to every state. So the collection included a moon rock. And basically, I had a display case probably 8 feet by 4 feet. He sat with me. We talked about how you come up with the theme, what storyline you're doing, what three dimensionals you have. And then he allowed me to decide all of that from title sign to text panels to, you know, what objects I was able to take from the collection. So it was really kind of the intro to museum exhibit experience for me.
And how long were you there for?
I want to say it was a semester. So that was probably, 6 months perhaps, and then was able to work after that working with him. But it was a short period of time, but it really allowed me to get my feet wet.
So were you doing your studies at the same time, or was this
a
full-time thing?
It was a work study while I was going to classes.
So how many hours a week was that?
Oh, yikes. You got me on that one, but I don't remember.
Yeah, okay, so it was a few hours a week.
A few hours a week.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that was in your undergrad, right?
Yep.
And so after you finished, what happened?
So then with that, I really knew that might be the direction I wanted to go in, and I began with my advisor's assistance exploring what universities, colleges had museum studies programs. I applied to a few of them and was accepted to Syracuse University for their museum studies. So I went there from 1981 through 83.
Was that very rigorous? What kind of classes did you have to take for that?
Syracuse had just started their program, so they had created it so that you, again, had a smattering of every aspect of museum work. So it was everything from curatorial, exhibit design, museum education, preparation of exhibits. We used to refer to it as kind of the blue-collar campus work for museum studies, because they really wanted to prepare all the students so that whatever aspect of museum work you were hired in, you were able to work within that aspect of museum work. So it wasn't like a Cooperstown program, which is almost purely curatorial, kind of working with the objects, doing the, you know, choosing the materials that would be displayed. Syracuse's program was, how do you prepare the walls to install an exhibit? And again, I loved that.
So you liked that whole practical, hands-on?
Yeah, exactly. There were some students in the program that were not pleased by that. They wanted to do purely the curatorial. It wasn't a good fit for them. But for me, that was, again, just the best.
That was because of your art background, no doubt.
It was. And honestly, I'm a hands-on kind of person, so I like creating and doing. I'm not afraid of a handsaw or a hammer. So that, in fact, got me a work-study position at Syracuse where I was working with the preparators. So Lenny Eichler was the man who did the installations on campus at their university gallery. So I was able to work with him. And that, you know, again, gave me that experience that proved so helpful, you know, years down the road.
Mm-hmm. So you completed your master's degree?
In all honesty, I've completed my coursework, but never officially graduated. As fate would have it, I was working on my thesis paper, semester ended, and I had anticipated going back to campus and completing, and was hired by the state of Connecticut that summer, and you know, never looked back. That thread was never completed, but in hindsight, it was fine.
So you were hired by the state of Connecticut at that point, and what were you hired to do?
I was at Syracuse 79 to 81, then was hired by the state of Connecticut in 83. They had a position open at the Prudence Crandall Museum. It was an entry-level position. It was for a museum guide. I was living in New Britain. The job situation in the 80s was typical to what it was the last few years for college graduates, where jobs were few and far between. That position came up. I jumped at it because it was something in my field, despite the fact it was entry level, but it was something that I was hoping that, again, would get me in a direction that I needed to go. Was hired as a museum guide. The museum at that point had yet to be open, but they were preparing for when the staff would come on board and the museum would open sometime soon after 83.
Okay. At that point, did you know anything about Prudence Crandall? Was she familiar to you because you had worked at the Connecticut?
Again, in the aspect of all honesty, I had no idea. I did what in those days was a Google search, but there was so little information on her. But I'm embarrassed to say I walked in cold. But since then, obviously, have realized how fortunate I was that I stepped into something that I didn't realize how important that thematically that museum was.
Let's give a quick introduction. We won't go into too many details of Prudence Crandall because a lot of people don't know who she is, and yet she's very important to Connecticut's history.
Sure. The short version of the answer would be that she's Connecticut's official state female hero. She is someone who was acknowledged to have that importance to Connecticut history because of the work she did in the 1830s, providing an education, a private education, to African-American young women. She was someone who was an educator, opened an academy in Canterbury, Connecticut in 1831, and being invited to do that by the community to educate daughters of the upper middle class white families in the region. And as fate would have it, when a young woman by the name of Sarah Harris, young black woman, 19 years old, comes to her in 1832, also wanting an education, both of their lives go in a direction that they never could have anticipated.
So we won't go into the history so much, and you'll have to visit the museum to find
out
more.
Exactly.
But we are going to continue with this museum, which when you got there, you were supposed to be a guide, and then things changed.
Things went very quickly after that. As it turned out, the woman who had been in the curator position had left. Jack Shanahan was the head of the agency, and I will mention, my career, I've been so lucky to work with some extremely wonderful people, especially as supervisors. I think that's important as a young person goes into the work experience. You have an idea of what it is to be a good supervisor. We've all had awful supervisors as well, but that allows us to have that skill set so that we can be better at it. Jack Shanahan was the head of what had been at that point, the agency was the Connecticut Historical Commission. He took me under his wing, mentored me, allowed me to, I took hold of the project from where the women who had been there prior to me had left it. And then soon after that, he promoted me so that I was put into a curatorial position soon after being hired, and then was able to get involved in really laying the groundwork for this. It was a empty building, but it was in no way, shape or form empty of importance. But it was a place that now needed exhibits, it needed collections, it needed public involvement and community involvement, and I found myself in the midst of that.
So before we go on further, could you define the difference between a museum curator and a museum director? Because you performed both duties.
Well, again, in all honesty, but I never had the title of museum director, but I was more of a site manager. So I did some curatorial work, but my responsibility was every aspect of that building's function. So it was everything from supervising staff to deciding on exhibits, program themes that we were working on. It was, again, what my work in Syracuse prepared me for was the position I found myself at the Prudence Crandall Museum.
Okay, so you walked into an empty shell, basically. that had been restored and maybe had been wallpapered and
all of the physical restoration of the property had been done. And fortunately for me, the staff prior to me had also put together idea lists of what might have been, what should be collected for furnishings that would come into the building, and also themes of exhibits that might be appropriate. So at that point is when, you know, we opened 1985. And then with that, I started doing outreach into the local communities, and we began developing a collections, kind of a, we used to call it a want list. So each of the rooms that were at that point empty had visual information on, in case your family happens to have a collection of early to mid 19th century furnishings and you would like to donate them, this is what we needed. And that actually prompted early in the museum's establishment, a woman out of North Carolina to make up, Aileen Dodge, made a substantial donation to the museum of period-appropriate furniture.
Mm-hmm. This is all pre-internet.
Yes, this is all word of mouth, phone calling, faxing, and letter writing. Yes.
And how many people were working with you?
I had a staff of, one. Yeah, it was myself and the woman when I was promoted. Cora came in as museum guide, and it was the two of us. And
everything.
It was fun. I mean, I was young and stupid, or it was fun because everyone who came into that building understood the importance of the storyline. And I'll tell you, if I had a nickel for every time someone, especially women, would come in and say, I'm not sure what brought me here, but I feel like I needed to come. And then they would start to tell a story or their personal experience or what have you. That museum, it just speaks to people on that, you know, the courage of women, how we can really achieve if we all stand shoulder to shoulder. It's an amazing building with an amazing story.
So how many years did it take you to sort of shape what is now the museum with all the rooms that are furnished and have photographs of artifacts or actual primary documents and things like that?
It was really the first 10 to 15 years that it really came to shape. And then funding became available. We started doing temporary exhibits. Those first 15 years also allowed me to get in touch with, because I'll be honest with you, I had a building that didn't have exhibits, and there were local historical societies and organizations that had materials for exhibits, but they didn't have a building. So the two, one hand washed the other. I was able to draw in, I think we worked with every historical society in Northeast Connecticut. We established collaborations, which then in turn became our grassroots support, especially during those less than positive years when the state budget cuts were threatening the closure of the state museums. I had a group of people who immediately were able to step in to do letter writing or campaigning for the museum. But it was those first 15 years were really laying a groundwork that have served the building right up until 2020.
So you had a lot of people get involved in the museum. Were you actually living near there as well at that time?
We've been living in Lebanon since when I took the job. My husband and I moved from, I was a New Britain person. He was Plainville. We got married and then have lived in the area since then.
Okay, so you were part of the community in a way, in
yes.
The greater community.
Yep.
What kind of, what was your typical day, let's say, at the beginning when you said you did a lot of letter writing campaigns and stuff like that, but when the museum was starting and people maybe didn't really know about it, what kind of stuff were you doing?
A typical day, really, 90% of our day, myself and Cora and then other museum guides that were other staff that was working with me was giving tours. We made sure that every visitor that came into that building understood, had a grasp of a storyline, which early on seemed to be more simplistic. Quaker woman opens school, is approached by young Black woman, changes student body, public pushback, legal action, school closes, off they go. that really began as we were doing research, and then with the blessing of the internet, where now I had connections with historians and educators and researchers all over the country and internationally even, who began providing information, so that that story began to develop into a, this is a local woman student body, which then it becomes an international story. Women's groups in the 1830s from Scotland and Great Britain and England, they know about what is going on in Canterbury. The abolitionists get involved. It's not just Quaker teacher, it's Quaker abolitionist movement, William Lloyd Garrison. And then the meat started getting on the bones of, this is the free Black community who is now becoming involved in their own social action, education for their children, and how Sarah Harris, her family is part of that. We really fleshed out that storyline so that it became much more complicated. And it became more complicated for our visitors, who it was much easier for them to understand. White woman provides education for, you know, free, and it, even in those early years, they assumed these are slave women, who they were not. These were daughters of free Black families. So it really necessitated our one-on-one with the public. And that not only provided more information to the public, it allowed the staff to hone our skills on what questions would an average person have for a very complicated story.
Mm-hmm. And how did Prudence become the heroine, the state heroine?
That happened, and this is part of it, from the mouths of babes, is how important things often happen. It all goes back to a class of youngsters from a school in the western part of the state had gone on a field trip to the state capitol. The League of Women Voters was giving the tour. The children are touring the capitol and see the statue of Nathan Hale, who was the state hero. And one kid in that group says, well, where's the statue of the lady hero? And they realized there wasn't one. So they started a campaign to finally get the state to recognize that they needed to have a woman who was doing something courageous. Prudence Crandall was in the league of someone they were, you know, they voted on, and the legislature, I want to say it was in 1995, gave Prudence recognition as she was the state female hero. And then some years after that, that same group of children organizes a fundraising campaign called Pennies for Prudence, and that led to the state creating a statue, which now is housed at the state capitol, and it's a statue of Prudence Crandall and Sarah Harris. So now when kids or groups go through the state capitol, they get a storyline of not only is Nathan Hale heroic for his deeds, but these two women were heroic for theirs in the 1830s.
Mm-hmm. So you played a real pivotal role in sharing Prudence's story and Sarah Harris's story.
It's hard for me to kind of acknowledge that because there were so, if I didn't have those people working with me, but I was so lucky to be able to be in a position where I had a building and a story that was so important that people really gravitated towards it. But yes, I'm thrilled to see, to be able to see that building go from, you know, no collections and a smattering of exhibits to where it stands now, where it's something that's recognized nationally. When I retired in 2018, visitors were coming from all over the world. I had a group of docents that were working with me that were, again, sharing their enthusiasm and their backgrounds with people from as far away as Israel and Germany and Korea, who were putting the museum on their travel agenda and itinerary because they needed to see this place where all this took place.
Wow, that's pretty incredible.
I'll tell you, there was a father and son from Israel that came, and as exciting and wonderful as that was for me to see my volunteers experiencing that and be able to share. And again, they saw that as the connection of suppression and, you know, their historical aspects of it that were so tangible and relevant and ran parallel to the storyline that they needed to come. Mm-hmm. Yeah, amazing.
And she's really become quite the figure in general. I mean, now when you mention her name, most people have heard of her, at least. They may not know her story, but her name is more familiar.
And that's when I knew we were really kind of hitting the nail on the head, when I could, early on, when I would go to a meeting and I would introduce myself and I would say, oh, I'm with the Prudence Crandall Museum. And the person would say, oh, I kind of heard of it. And when I left, you know, my position, wherever I went, if I introduced myself, it was instant recognition. So mission accomplished on that part.
Yeah, that's true. So what, if anything, I mean, we're kind of changing gears here, but what, if anything, prepared you as a child or a youth for this journey of museum creation and curation?
I think a lot of it was, and I'll be honest with you, when you'd gave me the questions on what we might be discussing, I really mulled that one over, because I thought, what made that a perfect fit? And I think part of it was, I had an older sister, and we were a family of storytellers. We would make up stories. We were both avid readers, spent our summers at the library as kids. You know, Thursday was library day, read. I would read anything and everything. You know, the goal was to read every book in the New Britain Children's Library, but that exposed us to a lot of different aspects of people's lives and storylines. So I think the realization that museum work on a broad scale, it seems daunting, like, you know, what do museums do? But it all boils down to, we tell stories. And the importance and relevance of museum work is what story we choose to tell. And I think at the Crandall Museum, I, my staff, my volunteers, anyone involved with the museum realized that it was important that we were telling everyone's story. It was not just the wealthy white woman who was able to get an education and establish an academy, and then kind of life takes a different direction. It's that average black family who chooses to give their children an education. Their story is as relevant as anyone else's. But I think that's what it was. It's basically, I love to tell stories and I love to listen to people's stories.
Yeah, and I actually, going back to the families that registered their children at Prudence's school, can you just give a little detail about the number of students that were registered and the types of families that they came from?
We have the names of between 20 and 22 students that attended, and that was during this, not all at the same time, but during those 17 months that the academy operated as one for African-American young women. They were coming from families who, A, had enough financial wherewithal to pay the tuition, because despite the fact that Prudence was changing her student body, she still required that $100 per year for them to make payments so that she could pay her bills and keep the building operating. Sarah Harris's background was, you know, her father was a farmer. She had two brothers that operated a restaurant establishment on the harbor in Norwich, Connecticut. So they had, we're assuming they pooled their money to send their daughter there. These girls are coming from Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Providence, from families who within those communities themselves are part of that. In the 1830s, that upper middle class free black population was growing in the United States. And that's where she's drawing from. These are families that have already been here for generations. The father might have been involved in sailing, had a business where he was able to earn enough to send a daughter to private school, and realized that that was the next step to benefiting the free black population. They needed to educate that next generation of children.
And is there any record of descendants from any of these?
We do. We actually know that many of the Harris family, the Fairweather, you know, Sarah Harris Fairweather, Shamir is George Fairweather, the Fairweathers, the Harrises went on to become teachers. The museum is in touch with a Fairweather family descendant out in the Midwest, and he's been doing a tremendous amount of research, genealogy on the family. And there are hundreds of teachers that came out of that lineage. There was a young woman that also attended by the name of Mary Elizabeth Carey Bibb. Mary Elizabeth Miles Carey Bibb She attended the academy in Canterbury as a youngster. She goes on to marry a man. She was married twice, but her first husband was Henry Bibb, who was himself had been enslaved when he was a young man, buys his freedom. They end up going to Canada. With the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act by the U.S. in 1851, that was prompting many Black individuals here in the States to head north. So they are heading to Canada. They establish what was considered the first radical Black newspaper in Canada. And Mary Elizabeth actually, ironically, goes on to establish a school for Black Canadian children. That school ends in mob violence the same way that that school did in Canterbury when she was a youngster. So here's a woman that experiences that kind of a pushback and violence as a child, and then experiences the same thing as an adult, because by the 1850s, that reaction was the same. That still, that fear by the white population of providing education to free Blacks was something that they couldn't comprehend. And many of the other students as well, if they themselves didn't become teachers, their daughters did. Their daughters also went on to become that generation that becomes involved in women's suffrage. So here in 2020, as we're celebrating or acknowledging the passage of the rights to vote for American women, those women that Prudence taught raised daughters who also were standing arm in arm to try to get votes for themselves when they become adults.
Mm-hmm. So very far-reaching when you think about it.
It is that those 1830s, the abolitionist movement is truly the first steps along that long line that ends and hasn't ended, but really culminates in the 1950s with the Civil Rights Act, Civil Rights Movement, Brown v. Board of Education, which in fact the Crandall School is mentioned in Thurgood Marshall's arguments before the Supreme Court. So that is a thread that goes all the way from Canterbury to, you know, Little Rock, Arkansas, with the desegregation of high schools in the 1950s. Even in retirement, I look forward to continuing the research and spending much more time to really try to get that, you know, there's so much more to learn that I wasn't able to in my time at Crandall.
So you say you're going to continue research, and do you have other plans of being involved in other museums, or is it more just personal research about?
Well, no grass growing under these feet. I had no sooner said out loud, really, that I was planning on retirement, and I was approached by the Colchester, Connecticut Historical Society. They had been working on a project. There had been what was referred to as the Colchester School for Colored Children that operated from 1804 to 1840. They had been doing research. They had done some projects with monies through the Connecticut Humanities. Were hoping to do an exhibit and approached me about if I might be interested in working on that. I brought in with me, which also I love working with people that I've met over my years at Crandall, Diana Ross McCain, who is a tremendous writer, historian, author here. She's local. She's Connecticut. The two of us came in, worked on the project, and an exhibit opened last May called Emerging from the Shadows, Colchester School for Colored Children, 1804 to 1840. And it's now open at the Colchester Historical Society. So again, that allowed me to use my background and interest in Black history, Connecticut history, and work with another organization. So yes, to short story long, I look forward to working with other historical societies as well as doing research on my own.
Okay, and my final question would be if you had any tips for people who might be wanting to get into the field.
I think try to get experience early on. Something, and I'll do a plug for one of my junior docents who, in fact, is now, you know, I met Hannah when she was 12. She's now at the University of Mary Washington in Virginia in their Preservation and Museum Studies program. The Crandall Museum has a junior docent program, which allows kids between the ages of 14 and 18 to come in to be involved in every aspect of museum work. I think if you're a young person looking to work in that field, or you're not sure, you don't know what that might provide for you, go to your local museum and ask if they can use any help, because I know the answer will be yes. See what kind of work they're doing. And what's so fortunate now, the programs that have evolved since I went to Syracuse are really looking at providing background so that you are truly marketable. You've come out with that skill set that you can do every level of museum work. And on the museum side of it, that's what museums are looking for. They don't want someone to be kind of pigeonholed or very narrow in what your skill set is. You need to be able to be flexible and work at every aspect of museum work. So that's the only advice I would give is, you know, go out there, whatever your age, and see how you can help your local museum. And that'll give you an experience. And even if you don't go into a museum work, that'll allow you to learn a little bit more about your local community.
Great. Well, listen, I really appreciate you coming in and talking to us.
Oh, you've made it. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure, Binay.
And hope you will all be inspired to check out the Prudence Crandall Museum and other museums and appreciate the work that goes into them. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I often marvel at life and who it puts you in contact with. And Kaz is one of those people. You know, I would never have known her had I not seen the performance so many years ago. It's so interesting in this creative world where everything's a process, you know, to get things done. And in life, everything's a process. And it's thanks to so many people that you get through it all. So anyways, I hope you appreciated the interview. I would like to thank WHUS Stores for making this podcast possible. It's really a blessing to be able to access a studio and have people helping you out. And I really appreciate that. Next on the process, we will be talking to Jean DeSmet, and she is the creator of Willimantic's Third Thursdays. Hope you tune in.